Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 81 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. A lot of people seem to have the impression that the Middle Ages was a time of unlimited and indiscriminate violence, so much so that people hardly noticed when someone was murdered in the street. I mean, this is the Middle Ages that we see on our screens all the time, right? So it may be surprising to learn just how actively medieval people tried to solve crimes and ensure that murderers were brought to justice. Anytime a person was killed, there were rules to be followed and there was paperwork to be done. Fortunately for us, the information written down in coroner's rolls can tell us a lot about crime and investigation in the medieval world. This week, Peter Konieczny stopped by to talk about the work he's done previously on coroner's rolls from 14th century London. Here's our conversation about what the coroner's job was, what some of the crime statistics of London were, and how people went about solving murders.
The jurors say that on Sunday before the Feast of St. Matthew, about the hour of curfew, the aforesaid Lucy came to the said shop in order to pass the night there with the said Richard Le Sherman and Christina his wife, as she oftentimes was accustomed, and because the said Lucy was clad in good clothes, the said Richard Le Sherman and Christina began to quarrel with her in order to obtain a reason for killing her for her clothes. At length, the said Robert took up a staff called Ballstaff, and with the force and assistance of said Christina, struck her on the top of the head, and mortally broke and crushed the whole of her head, so that she died forthwith. The said Richard and Christina stripped Lucy of her aforesaid clothes and immediately fled. But whither they went, or who received them, the jurors do not know.
All right, Peter, so tell us what you are reading from.
I am reading from a coroner's rolls from around the year 1321, and this happens in the city of London. So many, many years ago, I was looking at kind of violence and crime in London, and I came across these incredible sets of records about murders that happened in London. These are coroner's rolls. And I kind of spent some time kind of examining them, and it's just a fascinating world to look at kind of social history. So, yeah, we're going to talk about it today.
Yeah, let's talk about coroner's rolls. So let's start at the beginning. A homicide has happened in London. What happens next? There's a body. What happens next?
There's a body, and there's a cry goes in the streets. Well, they send an official called the coroner, and this is a person, kind of a London official. New one gets chosen each year, but sometimes they wind up repeating or come back a year or two later. And they come in, and this is their job to investigate. And the first thing they kind of do is they set up a jury of all the people, maybe a dozen people in the ward that this happens in, and says, all right, find out exactly what happened and tell me about this later that day.
So they like deputize the community to go and find clues?
They say, you know, you 12 people, tell us what happened, and we're going to take that information. And with the idea of apprehending the fugitives or figuring it out, and some these could be like just these are unexplained deaths. So like this could be, oh, we found someone like drifting off in the Thames River. Oh, you know, we have to figure out what happened. Or, oh, even some cases like, you know, or a child, you know, dies. We have to find out, we have to make sure that nothing was a foul. So we have to have an investigation.
Yeah, so I think that's important to kind of emphasize that somebody died in the Middle Ages. They didn't just get out the shovels. They called the coroner to try and find out not only what happened, but is it a suicide? Is it a murder? Is it an accident? They're trying to figure out what happened. And they kind of follow a lot of the same steps that we do today. So what else did they do as part of the investigation?
So and this is not just for London, but like in all of kind of England, all the kind of counties have their own coroner. Sometimes these would be like a knight, like in the counties would be like a knight or like another kind of minor nobility. And usually the jurors, the people they would pick would be nobles. In London itself, it's a bit of a different situation. But yeah, it's the coroner, that's his main job, is to explain unexplained deaths and also issue, basically get the process of going of an arrest warrant and kind of seizing any goods that were involved, which he has to keep and then account for at a later date.
Yeah, I think that's another thing people don't necessarily realize is that the investigations that people do into deaths, suspicious deaths especially, in the Middle Ages, they involve forensics, they involve forensic details. So what kind of stuff would people put in a coroner's report at the time?
You know, and this really ranges like from report to report, because like these are kind of records that, you know, kind of survive haphazardly. But we have actually like thousands of these records kind of dating from the 13th and 14th century all over England. And they've been doing kind of research all over from the late 70s on. There's been a lot of interest in these. So in some cases, we kind of know, all right, in our case, we know when this death apparently happened. We know we have like people saying that who the person that died was, when did they die, when would they, how, what kind of fashion would happen, what happened to the suspects. And we also learn a lot, like often sometimes we know who the jurors are. In London, this is like, they always tend to be like very diverse, like they're all men, mind you, the jurors. So. But they, you know, when I kind of read the records, like there was never like the same juror for every murder, right? It was all just a bunch of different people. So, but it was kind of fascinating to look at that as well.
Yeah, and they're collecting information from the scene, right? They'll tell you a little bit about how it looked when they arrived, where they went in the house. Like, did they look everywhere in the house? Where did they look? The kind of details that you find in like in a Sherlock Holmes story, you'd find somewhere else. I found blood on this, or the clothes were arranged in this way, right? They have that kind of detail in these reports.
Yeah, like a lot of the physical evidence is really interesting. Like you know, if there's a knife wound, what kind of knife, how deep it went, where it went, those things. They're very good at doing that. The one things that we, you know, there's a lot of stuff we don't know, right? Like, how did they come up with this information? Like, let's look at our kind of case where, you know, Richard and Christina kill.
Poor Lucy. Poor Lucy gets bludgeoned to death over her having nice clothes. That's really unfair.
Yeah. Now, like, so how does the jury know that these two people killed her? Apparently there's no other witnesses involved. We only have the dead person. We can assume that her clothes were taken. So, but the other two have fled. So now they come out like, oh, they started an argument. Like, did people hear this argument? Was it Richard that like hit her in the head with this particular weapon? Like they must, hopefully they have that weapon, you know, it's just kind of sitting there. But there's all that kind of detail, like how do they know? Like, and there are a lot of cases like where like there's only the accused and the victim, and like the accused is gone. And like in the one thing like you'll find is like in nearly all the cases, the accused has somehow run away, have fled. Sometimes they fled to a church. And they could wind up getting expelled from England, and sometimes they escape the church later. But other times they seem to have gone away. There's very few cases where there's an actual arrest.
Yeah, because like you say, in a case where they knew for sure who it was, that person might have claimed sanctuary or something like that. We had a podcast on sanctuary seekers with Shannon McSheffrey not that long ago. But sometimes it was people who would disappear. Right. And that was why they would have the hue and cry go out, where they would have everybody in the community needed to be called up, needed to be involved in making sure that they find the person, hopefully catch them red-handed, because if they can't catch them red-handed, they might not catch them at all. So while they're collecting all these forensic details and witness accounts, they're trying to track the person down. But often, as you say, like the accused might get away, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, we very rarely know what happens to the accused. Like, there's only like a couple of like in like the kind of records I've looked at. And I looked at 14th century London. There's about 8 years of surviving coroner's rolls, and I was able to kind of go through those. And there's about 160 homicides from that period. So in only I think it's really just a couple of cases that are there a person actually executed for the crime. And a few others, they wind up in jail. We don't know what happens. But like nearly all the other cases, they have fled.
Yeah, and I think it's worth saying that this is probably one of the reasons why there weren't as many executions in the medieval world as we think there were. In part, it's because sometimes the people just left. You never caught the person who was the killer. But I know that I can see Peter is looking at his chart of statistics, because deep in Peter's librarian soul is this need for statistics. And I actually love statistics when it comes to crime. So bring it on, Peter. What kind of stuff could you pull out statistically from looking at these? I think you said it was 8 coroner's rolls from London. Yeah. What did you pull out?
Yeah, we have from these 8 sets of records, we have 160 homicides, or what they say are homicides. So we know from them the gender of the victim. So 150 cases, they are men. 14 are female. So yeah, there are a couple of cases where there's multiple deaths The gender of the accused, again, mostly men. 252 men are accused of it, and only 21 women.
So there are more accused than there actually are murders. That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
In some cases, it's like him and his friends, you know, they attack, and they all, like three or four guys, you know, attack one other guy. So, yeah, you wind up seeing that, and... you know, it's interesting. Yeah, like you get like these multiple accuses when women kind of they're there. It's almost always with like another man. Like sometimes you have a case where like a woman, you know, it gets in a dispute with another woman, and she gets her brother or husband or neighbors, and they, you know, attack her on her behalf, and then they all flee.
Yeah, and in the Middle Ages, you could be accused as being a person who's murdering, even if you weren't the person who actually did it. So like as today, if you were involved in it, if you were egging someone on to murder, you would also be in trouble for that. What else do we have statistically speaking?
Yeah, we know the locations of where these homicides take place. And first we know where, like in parts of like what part of London, because they all say like which ward and which parish they say like this person was found in. So
okay, where should you not walk in medieval London?
Well, it's very much the edges of town, right? Like it's, you know, the kind of the walled area of town seems to be fairly safe. Like it's very, like it's not that, you know, there's really like a high crime rates. Like it could be that like parts are just much more populated, right? So, but it is the ones that seem to have the highest are the ones on the edges of town.
So if you ever get transported back to medieval London, stick to the middle of the city. Yeah. Stick to where you have crowds of people that you know. That's always good advice, right? Okay, what other stuff can you tell us about this?
Yeah, like half these homicides took place outside, like on the streets, just outdoors. So we have like 83 cases.
That is really interesting. So people are not committing homicide behind closed doors nearly as much as they do outside. That's fascinating.
Yeah, like you have, like in terms of like when it was the victim's house, that's about 18 times we have that. The attacker's house, 15 times. We have 15 times happening in a tavern.
Yeah, so, I would expect that to happen in a tavern, you know, at least 15 times, right?
And 6 times in a church or a churchyard.
That's an important detail too, because I think people imagine that everyone considered the church or the churchyard sacrosanct, but you know, murders still happen in the church and the churchyard.
And we, like, how thorough this? There's only like 9 cases of this, of the 160 that we looked at, where they don't really tell us where this took place. So it seems like one of those things that they always let you know that this happened.
Well, I mean, that's the first question. The first question you want to know, like, where did this happen? You know, after who, I guess, right?
And then we want to know when. So it tells us, like, the time of day. And not surprisingly, it happens at night.
Yeah, I think that's not a shocker, especially in a time without, you know, all these street lights like we have today. Under the cover of darkness, that's when the bad stuff happens.
Yeah, like we only have 8 cases that happen during what we'll call daytime, right? So usually they kind of say it happened at Vespers or at the hour of curfew, which will obviously be at night. That's often like something that they say. So I list out 8 in daytime, 35 in evening, and 100 that happen overnight.
So watch out. Get yourself indoors because these are happening outdoors at night, which really, when you look at the number of accused being higher than the number of, you know, actual victims, it sounds like a lot of these are ambush. It's kind of disturbing.
So when do you think will happen, like, of days of the week?
Days of the week? I don't know. These days, we kind of, like, arrange our times so that like party times are Friday and Saturday nights. So, you know, these days I would imagine there's higher crime on Friday and Saturday nights. Is it the same in the Middle Ages?
Oh, it's Sundays.
Sundays? Oh, do you think it's because like Sundays people aren't working so they're partying instead? You think that's why?
That's right. It's like that socializing. So we have like the cases 53 happen on Sunday and then 31 happen on Monday.
Wow. Okay, so it might be like this overnight Sunday to Monday, right? Do they count as Sunday or Monday?
Sometimes it's hard to tell, right? But like that's like maybe they find the body on a Monday, right? And they like, or it's this kind of lingering effect, right? Like, but like all the other days are like between 10 and 20. So Tuesdays there's 10 cases. Saturday was 19 cases. The others are kind of in between. There's only three cases where we don't know which day the event happened.
So, like, the coroners have an extra reason to hate Mondays because Monday they're going to be run off their feet. I'm just kidding, because when you think about it statistically, 160 murders, 164 murders, or whatever it is still a very low amount considering the time over which these are collected. So it's not like people are getting murdered every day, every Sunday night.
Yeah, in terms of like months of the year, I looked at that, and that's very kind of, there's not much deviation. Like, the lowest month happened to be September, which was 9, I recorded. The highest month was November, which was 19. So it's not like there's even like a seasonality to it. Like, these are just happening all kinds of time. Like, throughout the year, it's a pretty kind of standard.
Yeah, although November is a bummer of a month for everybody, right? November is a time that's dark, and I don't just mean literally, but it is a time when it is literally dark, which would mean, you know, everybody would be lights out a lot earlier. So you'd have streets that were darker for longer in a month like November.
Yeah, I would think that. But then December becomes 12. In January, it's 10. February, it's 11. You know, so it's
Christmas season. Maybe you don't feel like killing people over the Christmas season.
It's just getting cold and people wanted to, you know, hang. But yeah, it's a very kind of fascinating kind of look. Like why it doesn't it have really much of a big difference in, you know, a seasonality or a change in months. Like, you know, it happens on a certain, like, happens on particular days much more often, but not, they're all spread out throughout the year.
So this is something that it's not very easy to track in terms of statistics, but does it pretty much always tell you the motive, or is that something that it doesn't usually tell you?
A lot of times it doesn't. And, like, you know, it will depend on the year. Like, they will say in a case, they were fighting beforehand. They were having kind of, you know, an ongoing dispute. In other cases, they say they just met up. You know, there's a few cases where they'll give a bit more information and stuff like that. But then again, it's hard to tell, like, you know how accurate this could come from. So, you know, where you have kind of servants that, you know, kill their, their master, and then, husband and kills the wife or something like that. You know, it seems to be like they had some dispute, you know, but how do we know? Like, there sometimes I was able to pick up information, right? Like, a little extra information. Like, there was one case where an armorer was killed in a shop. And what I was able to kind of find, because I was also doing research on London's military role, was they were both actually a few months earlier had served in the same company. That, like, the city of London has sent out a company of soldiers to Scotland, like 100 men. And the armorer was actually the commander of that. And the other person was another soldier. So they had some sort of relationship, at least from that. Well, of course, that does not come out in a coroner's role. They just say, like, one person killed the other. But, like, so you see, there must have been some sort of long-lasting kind of, there must have been something that was going on, so.
Maybe some sort of bad blood or something going on between those two people that caused something. Yeah, I wouldn't expect there to be a lot of motive written down, because you might not know, because you might not talk to the person. Or it might be something that people kind of just assume that they already know. They don't need to write down. This might be something that everybody knows. But I think about, you know, people were collecting stuff like forensic detail. But when you think about it, a lot of it was eyewitness testimony, which is something that is not very reliable, as we know.
When these kind of came out, like, started studies in the early, like, late 70s and early 80s, one of the kind of criticisms that came out was that these, if you look at these coroner's roles, it's often like, oh, a fight that started, and it was like people, like, the idea was, oh, people are just, you know, just so violent, and, like, they were, like, what we call trigger happy, right? They were knife happy, like, just where, like, the slightest altercation seemed to come along. And so you have to really kind of read that in context, that you're getting the bare bones information collected by not police officers or experts, but, like, this is just the people that they were able to gather around to kind of come up with an idea of what happened, right? Like, this is the first draft of law. So
yeah, you're asking your neighbors, you know, what do you know about this? Like, what can you tell us about this person? And they may know nothing, may not have any idea of the relationship, or the fact that, you know, these two men that you were talking about were in the same company. That might be something that not everybody actually knew. So that would be something that it wouldn't end up in there because people didn't actually know that. But you mentioned trigger happy. You mentioned people being knife happy. What were some of the weapons that people used to kill each other in London in the Middle Ages, 14th century?
Well, not surprisingly, most were a knife or a dagger. So there's 100 cases that was involved a knife or a dagger. Next one is like a staff or stick, right? So like in this case, Lucy's case was a ball staff, right? So I call that like, so there was 32 cases of there. And then we have swords, 24. And then it really goes down to some really, like a bow and arrow. One person got shot with a bow and arrow. One person got killed by a lance. 9 people in hand-to-hand combat. So just punches and kicks.
Wow. Or I would guess like strangulation would appear under there as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. And we have 2 cases where people drowned. So a person, they threw them into the river or down a well or something like that.
Ooh, nasty.
And that axe or pole axe to the head, you know, 3 times.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, it does really speak to the fact that you use what's handy. And in this time, everybody has a knife on them, right? You need knives for everything, especially for eating. You could stab people with an eating knife. I mean, that would not be as effective as, you know, the type of knife that you'd use for actual fighting, but you use what you have to hand. And I remember reading something in a book about archery where the more people who practiced archery, and this is exactly the right time for that, where Edward III has people practicing archery all the time, they committed more murders with bows, but they didn't actually string them. They used them to bludgeon people, which is something that you see actually here. It takes a while to string a bow, but you can actually bludgeon somebody with it if you're, you know, hot-blooded at the time.
You know, one of the fascinating things I saw when looking at London's city records was there's the occasional law that gets put in place. We're banning the use of like swords and like long daggers, right? Like you were not allowed to carry them around the street with you. Of course, there's pushback against that because, you know, people want to carry their weapons. So especially the nobility, like it's like, so they have to make exceptions for that. But you see that coming again and again, like, where, you know, the modern day gun ban, you know, in back in medieval London are trying to ban swords.
Well, that's the thing, because, you know, we know that if you have a weapon, you are more likely to use a weapon, right? Some of the stuff that you said here, that hand-to-hand combat, it is very few of the murders that are happening. If you have a weapon, you're more likely to use a weapon. And I think that's something that's kind of true no matter what time period you're in, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, it's just the use of weapons. And like, we have to remember there's also a period where it's, you know, medical advances are still pretty, you know, meager compared to ours. So a person could bleed out from a wound. In like some cases, you know, we have some cases people die right away, but others, they live on for several weeks before like it's just they die from their wound. So,
yeah. And when you have somebody who has been given a critical wound these days, you can get an ambulance to them quickly. You can get them to the hospital quickly. But now you figure you're trying to get them to a barber surgeon or a doctor or a healer or something. You have to transport that body there. You don't have an ambulance coming to you, putting you on a stretcher. You have to get there yourself. And if you're by yourself in the dark, you know, it's going to take a longer time than an ambulance would today.
Oh, yeah. It's so like there are a few cases where you see like the person was taken by friends back to their house and there was an attempt to treat them. And like you hope that those cases that we know more because the victim is around to tell their tale for some time. So, but yeah, it's just kind of a fascinating look, you know, that part of, you know, this kind of damage done. And they're very specific on these wounds, right? So like, you know, this wound was 4.5 inches, right? So.
Yeah. And I think, again, like this is something that we may not consider when people think about the Middle Ages being kind of more of a primitive time. They might just think that this is not the type of detail people collect or are concerned with, but they're very concerned. I mean, not only because people are curious and they want to know what's going on, but concerned with identifying what the murder weapon is so that they can find it later so that they can bring someone to justice. Like people who are concerned with these forensic details. I remember hearing a paper at Kalamazoo where a person was talking about sword styles, and they had collected some stuff from coroner's rolls where they had witnesses saying it looked like a Scottish sword. So, you know, you have this distinctive weaponry that people are trying to identify so that they can find the murder weapon and maybe find the murderer later if they can't find them right away.
There's this fascinating text out of medieval China where like an official there that was, he was kind of like a judge. And he had figured out all, like, you know, what were the circumstances of a person dying? Like, was it murder or not? Like, how could you figure it out? Like, and he's like, well, if he fell this way, you know, he was hit from this side. Like, here would be the bruises. Is like, if he fell down the well, if he was thrown down, he would have been moving his hands. But if, you know, if he was knocked out and thrown down, he wouldn't see that. So, like it was very fascinating forensic. Like, it's something like I was just mind blown, like how thoughtful he could put into trying to solve these cases of murders.
Yeah, it might not be something that you'd collect in a book necessarily. I mean, we talk about Sherlock Holmes and stuff, but around that time, people were collecting in books and databases and sharing, like Scotland Yard and stuff, sharing this information so that everybody has the same information about what a certain crime looks like. But at this time, you have coroners who are speaking to each other and the experience of people on the battlefield. They'll be able to recognize things like defensive wounds. But they may not actually write that down because that's just something that they know in their head.
I've always, one of my little dreams, pet dreams, is to write a novel where it'd be set in London, 14th century London, and the main character would be the coroner, right? And, you know, the jury would, like, come back and say, you know, oh, it was this person, but the coroner, he's like that Sherlock Holmes type, like, oh, I'm going to find out who really did it, right? And, like, uncover the case with the clues and stuff like that, so...
Yeah, because I mean, that's something that actually would happen. People would be looking at that wound and trying to solve this mystery. And you'd be calling in people like doctors and experts who would know this kind of stuff and tell you what is the cause of death, because it's really important. Was this a natural death? Was it an unnatural death? Sometimes it doesn't show on the outside of the body, like, you know, a poisoning case.
There are there's a few cases out there where like you can, there's been more effort put into the solving of the crime. Like, so there's one case where a couple of servants of like a skinner and a fishmonger, one of them gets killed by the other. And what was interesting, like, first you study the read record, and it's like they have the local jury, and then they have like a jury of skinners, and they have a jury of fishmongers, right? Of course, those latter two, like, they have different like stories, like, but trying to figure it out. And at first it was like, well, why did they have like this? This seems to be a normal case, and I matched it up with a brawl that happened in London that same day, and probably was involved the same thing, where the mayor and his like officials tried to intervene, and a person grabbed the mayor, attacked him, and another person used a stick on one of his big bodyguards and like kind of, you know, basically bashed his head in. And that was a huge issue. This happens like in 1340 in London, where you know, this brawl breaks out. Like, this is a time when England's at war, and like Edward is not in the country at the time, so he actually had given the mayor special powers. So this is the only time I ever came across where the mayor was able to execute a person. He executed a person that grabbed him. So
mayor gets his revenge.
Mayor gets his revenge, but they were so worried that the English king would come down on them for doing this that there was a lot of like ink spilled in the records, where they wound up getting like 300 people to kind of agree, like citizens to come up and say, yeah, this was a good thing. This, we had to do it. And there was like letters to the king. Yeah, we had to do this. Was it okay? Because you said we could.
Yeah, that's important, in that the higher profile cases, you often have more paperwork. I mean, that's the same today, right?
Yeah. So one of my most like favorite cases actually happens later. It's from like 1379, so it's not part of these coroner's rules, but we found it in like later records, like a royal records. So there's this person named Janus Imperial, and he's from Genoa, and he gets killed on the street. And it's like very, like, they have the coroner's rule, like the coroner's comment, it's like the jurors, like, there was a fight and we don't know what happened. That was like their first, like, which was really odd, because like nearly all these cases, the jurors know, like, give some idea of, like, they name a suspect, right? But this is a case where like they don't, and they ask him again like a week later, hey, did you find anything? No, we didn't find anything. And then like about like 2 months later, they did find something, because there had been two suspects arrested at this point. So the jurors say, oh yes, these two people were involved, but it was self-defense. Like, they came on, they got into a scuffle with Janus, and Janus attacked him. And yeah, you know, it was there, but they still hold a trial, right? And the jurors say, no, it was self-defense. These two people should get let go. The Crown does not let them go. They move them from London to Tower of London. So you can see that they're not even in the local prison. They're like in the high posh prison. But they move them to Nottingham and they keep them there until like one of them confesses, right? They get a confession. So we have like these records, and the confession is like, yeah, you know, me and him, we tried to provoke a fight with Janice. So we walked by him three times, trip over his feet. You know, like, so it's not only the third time that his servants kind of bring it up. As soon as they do, you know, once servants get angry, you start taking out, one of us attacks a servant, the other just bashes the Janice's head in. And so, and he reveals like why, and he also gives out why, right? And these happen to be servants of wool merchants in London, like fairly well, like, you know, off wool merchants. And there's a whole bunch of them that seemed to have been wanted to get rid of Janice because he was actually in London to sign a treaty between London and Genoa about trade, as well as also to get the ship back that like pirates had taken from the Genoese. And so they were like, oh, they're going to ruin our economy. So, but what's kind of fascinating is like, were the jurors in on it, right? Like that's like, there's one thought is that the jurors, you know, knew all along and they, you know, they were just playing along and they didn't want to say it. But I'm kind of thinking that the jurors, like they may have been like they hated for like that hatred of foreigners or just like, oh, it was a foreigner, let's get rid of him. But that these guys made an effort to kind of conceal their crime, like to try and get into a fight. Like they didn't just come up and attack him, you know, for no reason. They tried to make it look like kind of a fight that went awry. So
yeah, because in the case of self-defense, you wouldn't get in trouble for it because it wasn't your fault necessarily. So yeah, I mean, it's smart to try and provoke a fight if you can, even though probably everyone could see right through that, I think, right away.
Yeah, self-defense was one of the ways that people could get off. The other was getting a pardon. So that's like, that's far more what happens than like a conviction, is like they get a pardon, often for doing military service.
I would think you get a pardon for doing military service if you were poor. You could get a pardon for your crime if you were rich. And again, this is something we talked about with Shannon McSheffrey. You could get a pardon much more easily if you were rich.
Yeah, yeah. Like there are a lot of cases of that, of these pardons in military service. Like, you know, it's hard to tell like the how wealthy these people are, because like, there's a lot of people, they like when they say, oh, how many chattels they have like nothing, but apparently they have servants. So, it's interesting on that. So, you know, we don't really know very much about the economic backgrounds of these people. So it's just because the records are just too odd on that.
I was thinking back to coroners and what people have invested in actually solving murders and stuff like that. And I think that something I want to mention is that it was important for people to understand a crime, especially in a time like this when people's souls were on the line as well. If somebody was determined to have been a suicide, they couldn't be buried in the churchyard, for example, and that would be a peril to their mortal soul. If somebody was murdered, that would be a peril to somebody else's mortal soul. So one of the things I wanted to mention before we wrapped up this stuff about coroners is that it wasn't just important to figure out what happened for the sake of justice, but also for the sake of people's immortal souls, which is what they were actually really concerned with in a lot of cases too.
Yeah, it's interesting to see like how to say, like they set this up, like how invested are the local citizens about this. There may be some cases where, you know, a person was, you know, clearly acting outside of, you know, like normal social boundaries. Like I think if, especially they really didn't like foreigners, right? Like there's a lot of anti-foreigner stuff in London, like which can be like, when we're talking foreigners, like this in 14th century is often like people in from low countries or France or Germany. Those are they tend to be blamed for everything, right? Causing a lot of trouble. So, you know, yeah, like how much are people invested? Like nearly everybody gets away, you know, like in this case. And there are some like from earlier records, people like are arrested, but they're the wrong person, just have the same name, which is not very tough in medieval England. But it's, yeah, you get this, like, you know, how people, like, you know, what happened to the people that are accused? They they seem to get away, but like you can, even in the city of London, you can easily slip in through the crowd, right? You know, in some cases, you know, they are arrested like a couple weeks later with like this town, like in this case where the person attacked the mayor, he was hiding out somewhere in town and it was just like, they were calling for him to be arrested. And it was like, eventually, he just turns himself in, right? But if you were in London, you got committed crime, like, or even if you're innocent, but a person dies by unexpected, you seem to want to get out. And maybe all you have to do is, like, once you get out of the city, like, nobody's going to know who you are. And there's no such thing as documents, you know, proof, you know. So it's, you know, like, you might lose your livelihood, but you gain your life.
Yeah, it's possible to disappear. I mean, I think maybe not everyone could disappear because, you know, the proof that you want is your social proof, and it's in communities where people knew each other, you know, it would be weird to have a stranger. You might cause suspicion. But yeah, a lot of people disappeared. But that said, the coroner was there to try and solve the mystery. And we could talk about this forever, but is there one last thing you want to tell us about coroners in London and crimes in medieval England especially?
You can look for this not just from London but like different towns like Oxford. There's some reports, there's all sorts of other kind of records of crime. London is just a fascinating place to look at for like social history. Like the city records are full of like cases of assaults as well, so we have that. You know, all various kinds of little misdoings and nicer things as well. Like, you know, like London is if you want a place to kind of do research, London has like tons and tons of documents from the city doing this or that, policing to water, bringing in water into the town. So yeah, I would certainly urge anyone that's interested in looking for a medieval topic. And if you're a writer, if you're a novelist, oh my gosh, you should tell, you know, look at these coroner's roles and just use one as the basis of your like mystery novel.
I think that's great advice. Okay, thanks, Peter, for sharing this research of your own with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Before we go, we want to find out what is on the website this week. So what's going on, Peter?
So there was an interesting discovery in southern England just announced. It's not just remains of any warrior discovered by archaeologists, but a warlord and a 6th century warlord to boot. So we've got news on that. We have a lot of news this week, including an online course on medieval cooking that's starting next month. So I think a lot of listeners might be interested in that. Plus, we're starting to get into the Halloween spirit. So with Catherine Walton, and she's got a piece on Merlin and the demons who made him.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I think we have a pretty good month here on medievalist.net. A lot of content coming out. So I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com for your continuing support each and every month. I sincerely hope that you're enjoying all your goodies, from subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, as well as your book club books and exclusive maps. I gotta say, these maps by Tina Ross have been pretty awesome, and they're perfect for teachers, as well as readers and other historians. If you haven't checked out all of our amazing rewards yet, you can find them at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from cooking classes to warlords, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sobalski, across social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist. And you can find all my books, including the new one, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, which just had its 1-year anniversary, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening. And have yourself a wonderful day.